So this word, dukkha, does everyone know that word? Anyone not know that word? Isn't it a great word, dukkha? D-U-K-K-H-A, dukkha. And it is the word used to describe the kind of unsatisfactory nature of experience, that nothing ever quite meets our expectation. Or if it does, it doesn't last. So dukkha, it's the human condition. You know, there's no escaping dukkha. So really, our practice is about growing in wisdom in relationship to the dukkha that is present in our lives. And we were just speaking about that. So I just wanted to read this poem by Polish poet. So this is in relationship to how we add a degree of dukkha or suffering in the way we hold on to identities. In Praise of Self-Deprecation by Wisława Szymborska. The buzzard has nothing to fault himself with. Scruples are alien to the Black Panther. Piranhas do not doubt the rightness of their actions. The rattlesnake approves of himself without reservations. The self-critical jackal does not exist. The locust, alligator, trichina, horsefly, live as they live and are glad of it. The killer whale's heart weighs 100 kilos, but in other respects, it is light. There is nothing more animal-like than a clear conscience on the third planet of the sun. So why do we practice? What brings us to practice? Great Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi, he said, actually, we meditate to enjoy our old age. Isn't that great? But what does it mean? In the narrative of the Buddha's journey of awakening, we hear how he was inspired to leave his life of comfort because he encountered four messengers. Not literal messengers, but people who embodied some aspect of the human condition. As he was exploring the world with his friend and companion, he saw an old person, a sick person, he saw a corpse, and then he met a wandering renunciant. But with the first three encounters, the young prince, Siddhartha Gautama, was deeply moved. He asked his companion if these states of being, this aging, illness, and death, would also be true for him, if these conditions would assail his own body. And when the answer came back, that death and aging and illness cannot be escaped by anyone, he was left to ask himself, who am I to seek happiness in that which is also subject to change, if my body is also subject to change? But when he met the fourth messenger, a wandering renunciant, he was struck by the individual's presence. This man radiated equanimity and peace. And the Buddha-to-be realized that there were those who had let go of their worldly attachments and who had begun to seek a different path. And he too could make that choice. So, you know, we're not setting off into the wilderness to practice, but we have made a similar choice. When we dedicate a day or 2 days to mindfulness practice, we are going against the stream of our society, which tells us to get busy. You know, check off all those chores and to-dos on your list. We are doing something quite radical. And at different times we may wonder, well, what's the point? Why am I doing this? There's so much that needs attention in the world. But the attention we dedicate to our hearts and our minds means that when we step into the community, we step into our home environment, we bring ourselves and we offer something truly valuable. Presence, kindness, compassion, the ability to meet the difficult circumstances that arise. So we are swimming against the current and we are investing in our own happiness. So when Suzuki Roshi said, we meditate to enjoy our old age, what might he actually mean? And so I came up with a few ideas, and I'm sure you could come up with a few of your own. And wherever we begin and however we come upon this practice, whether it's in our youth, in our midlife, or as we grow older, this practice of mindfulness and meditation instills the ability to appreciate each moment in time. No matter the circumstances. So we learn how to meet what is painful, what is difficult, and open to it with interest and genuine friendliness, which allows us to stay connected. And even when there is resistance or fear, we can turn our attention to that experience as well. Resistance feels like this. Fear feels like this. And you could say that when we practice mindfulness, we're actually preparing ourselves to meet the changes that are inevitable. I used to be a runner. I used to love setting off for a run in the morning, especially on trails. And at a certain point, you know, my knees said, I'm sorry, you are destined now to be a walker. And the physiotherapist said, if you want to continue enjoying walking, you have to give up running. So it was a letting go. And when I see, you know, people on a rainy morning or a snowy morning or a sunny morning setting off for a run, a little twinge like, oh, used to enjoy that. My nephew, he would tell me about his 10-kilometer runs in the woods or along the road. May you enjoy that as long as you can. So we prepare to accept loss and change, and even to have a spirit of playfulness and creativity as we grow older. A few years ago, I gave a class called Dancing with the Messengers, which was about aging and encountering these messengers with a sense of playfulness and grace. Loretta, who was here yesterday, she came to my class tending the spark on mindfulness and creativity. She was telling me yesterday, she said, she doesn't know what's next. Maybe she'll take up the ukulele. Why not? So His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. Could anything be more simple? And as we practice, meditation, I think we really uncover our own goodness. We pay more attention to our speech and our actions. We recognize that we are part of a great web of life. And we realize that how we are in the world does make a difference. To live a generous life, to nurture an attitude of friendliness in our interactions with the world, is to live a life with few regrets. And what greater gift could we give to ourselves and to others than this? This nurturing of the kindness that is within. You know, at the end of a person's life, in the Buddhist tradition, it is said that one of the most helpful things to do is to remind them of their goodness and all the good they have accomplished. So, a third way is that mindfulness and meditation sharpens our sense perception. I spoke about that yesterday, falling in love with sense perception. Of course, we live in paradise here in Victoria. So to really feel ourselves nourished by the beauty that surrounds us, and at the same time holding a larger perspective on time and the changes that are wrought by time. The Japanese poet Ryokan came home one evening and surprised a thief in the process of stealing his few possessions. What did he do? He was a poet and a Zen monk. He composed three lines. The thief left it behind, the moon at my window. So this kind of attentiveness brings an increased capacity to take great joy in the simplest of pleasures and to share those joys with children and friends. The sound of rain on the roof, the scent of pine needles on a summer afternoon, the taste of a ripe blackberry. We learn how to savor this moment in time, and we prepare our hearts to receive the ongoing, ever-present teaching on the truth of change. So we open to perception, we receive the gift of sense experience, and we also receive the gift of the fact that it all changes and dissolves. Even now, the light is changing. Finally, our meditation practice becomes a lifelong companion. Whether we are single, married, widowed, divorced, most of us in a life will encounter moments of great aloneness. And often we think there's something wrong when we're alone, something that needs to be fixed. So the writer Natalie Goldberg, her teacher Katagiri Roshi would say to her, "Can you stand up with loneliness?" In other words, can you meet that experience? And what is it? Also, it changes. Sometimes it's a deep ache for companionship and friendship. Sometimes it is a longing for another's presence in the midst of this journey. But with a practice of mindfulness and meditation, awareness itself becomes our companion and guides and gently guides us to stay interested, encouraging us to watch the emotions that come and go, reminding us that others too have traveled this path. Though we may feel the pang of loneliness, we are never alone. Awareness is there with us. To have a practice of meditation is to prepare ourselves for the unavoidable an inevitable disintegration and dissolution of all that we call me or mine. So why do we come to practice? To enjoy our old age, to live without regrets, and to nurture this capacity to accompany ourselves through the unpredictable and inevitable changes of life. So one aspect of the practice that we've been exploring is these beautiful qualities, the five spiritual qualities, which are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I wanted to share with you a story which I think really encompasses all of these qualities. And this isn't a story from the Buddhist tradition, it's a story from the Quaker tradition. Now, have any of you any experience with that tradition?
You said
Quaker? Quaker.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So, in the late 18th century, there was a Quaker named John Woolman who lived in New Jersey in colonial times. His story is of particular interest because the Quakers believed in consensus. They made decisions through consensus. And they believed that majority rule was actually a form of violence, an imposition of decisions on some of the population who disagreed. So they always make decisions by consensus. And the decision in the case of John Woolman was one of immense moral urgency. It was the question of slavery. So he was a tailor by trade, and he lived among Quaker farmers and merchants. And their beliefs held that all human beings were equal in the sight of God. At the same time, their affluence depended heavily on slave labor. So he saw the contradiction. He saw this inconsistency between a belief that was apparently shared by all and a practice that was accepted, that of keeping living human beings as slaves. He received a revelation from God that slavery was a moral abomination and that Quakers should set their slaves free. For 20 years, at great personal cost, he devoted himself to sharing this revelation with members of his community. When he visited a remote farmhouse to speak of his conviction, he would fast rather than eat a meal prepared or served by slaves. When he discovered that he had inadvertently benefited from a slave's labor, he would insist on paying that person. So his message was not always well received by his fellow Quakers, who were as adept as anyone at contradicting their own beliefs. Woolman's message, if it were to be embraced, would require the comfortable Quaker gentry to make a considerable financial sacrifice. So, it's so interesting because he received the blessing to go on this journey and to speak with Quakers across the country. And his home community said, "We encourage you to do this, and we will support your family while you are gone." But they weren't ready to make a kind of universal decision and impose their decision on the majority. They believed that actually Quakers needed to hear his conviction, to see the awakening of his faith, and to be moved by the energy and dedication that he embodied as he went on foot across the country. So for 2 decades, he traveled from town to town, from farm to farm, from meeting to meeting, speaking his truth and standing in the gap between the Quaker vision of God in every person and the reality of Quaker slave holding. In 1783, half a century and more before the United States erupted into civil war over the question of slavery, the Quaker community decided to free all of their slaves, and they petitioned the Congress of the United States to correct the complicated evils and unrighteous commerce created by the enslavement of human beings. From 1827 onward, Quakers played a key role in developing the Underground Railroad. So interesting. So they took a stand because of one man who was able and willing to hold the tension between belief and practice. So it's important to note, and this I'm drawing very much here on the writings of Quaker educator Parker Palmer. So he says, it is important to note that the entire Quaker community was willing and able to hold that tension between belief and practice until all its members were open to a way of life congruent with their deepest convictions. They refused to resolve the tension prematurely, either by throwing Woolman out or by taking a vote and allowing the slavery-approving majority to have its way. Instead, they allowed the tension between vision and reality to break their individual and collective hearts open to justice, truth, and love. So I think of that story as really emblematic of the awakening of faith, the arousing of energy, the application of mindfulness, the gathering and one-pointedness of concentration, and also this incredibly essential element of wisdom. Wisdom actually knows, when is it appropriate to speak the truth? When is it appropriate to take action? In friendships, in community. In the small group, we spoke about these beautiful trees, mature oaks and sequoias that apparently have recently been cut down at a property that was once owned by the Victoria Truth Center and is now being developed as a housing complex called Bellwood, ironically. So a group creatively united for, I think it's called Creatively United for the Planet, through their initiative, the City of Victoria will soon be appointing an individual in charge of the urban forest. So, you know, we can protest and regret and lament such unnecessary, in my view, taking down of ancient trees, and we can also take action for the future. Interestingly, some of those trees, according to research done by one of the members of that community, were planted from acorns brought over from England that came from a tree that grew on a hill, and underneath that tree, in the shade of which Wilbur force, one of the founders of the anti-slavery movement in England. It was under that tree that he planned his campaign against slavery. And so they're called Emancipation Oaks. Remarkable piece of history right there. So stories, you know, we think about how these teachings are often presented as a series of lists. We spoke about that a bit at lunch, you know, and these lists can be helpful for remembering concepts, but actually stories, personal stories and historical stories, they land in the heart in a way that really touches us and moves us and reminds us. So I want to share one more story. And this one you may have heard before. It comes from Jack Kornfield, who is a teacher and a wonderful storyteller. And it's a story about forgiveness. And, you know, it's a very dramatic story, but I think that it reminds us that forgiveness is also a practice of letting go. And sometimes we're not ready. But when we are ready, what benefit to ourselves and to others when we can let go of resentment and grudges that sometimes are kind of lingering in the mind. So once Jack was on the train from Washington to Philadelphia, he found himself seated next to a man who'd worked for the State Department in India, but had quit to run a rehabilitation program for juvenile offenders. In the District of Columbia, most of the youths he worked with were gang members who had committed homicide. So just, you know, to think of a young person committing homicide. One 14-year-old boy in his program had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to his gang. At the trial, the victim's mother sat silent until the end, when the youth was convicted of the killing. After the verdict was announced, she stood up. She stared directly at him and she said, "I'm going to kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve several years in the juvenile facility. After 6 months, the mother of the slain child went to visit her son's killer. He had been living on the street before the killing, and she was the only visitor he'd had. For a time, they talked, and when she left, she gave him some money for cigarettes. Then she started, step by step, to visit him more regularly, bringing him food, small gifts. Near the end of his 3-year sentence, she asked him what he would be doing when he got out. He didn't really know. So she offered him a job with a friend's company to help him set that up. And then she asked him where he was going to live. And since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her own home. For 8 months he lived there. He ate her food, and he worked at the job. So you can see that because she showed him some respect, she showed him some faith, he was able to hold that job. I'm sure it wasn't easy. Then one evening, she called him into the living room to talk. She sat down opposite him and waited. Then she said, "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "I'll never forget that moment." "Well," she went on, "I did. I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die, That's why I started to visit you and bring you things. That's why I got you the job and let you live in my house. That's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. And so now I want to ask you, since my own son is gone and that killer is gone, I want to ask you if you'll stay here. I've got room, and I'd like to adopt you if you'll let me. And she became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he never had. So there is something there in that story. And, you know, this practice of ours, we do it quietly. We do it in the space of our own homes or on retreat. But when we step into the world, we bring the medicine of awareness. Each time we say to someone, in however we're going to say it, each time we say, I see you. Each time we say, I hear you. Each time we reflect to them their gifts and their potential. And that's incredibly healing. That's what Jack's story is showing us, the potential to say, I hear you, I see you, I care about you. So, a couple of stories to take away with us, and then just a few more words before we close and stretch for the final instructions. But really, you know, this practice, a journey towards self-knowing, self-understanding, befriending ourselves, accompanying ourselves, learning to live without regrets. It's also a journey about developing a wise relationship to dukkha, to the suffering that is present in our lives. And, you know, yesterday there was someone who spoke about anxiety, and someone else who spoke about physical pain. And there are, of course, the different kinds of suffering we encounter through loss and through unexpected change in our lives. So these are all forms of dukkha. Not getting what we want, or getting what we don't want. So, so what this leads us towards is through the practice of mindfulness, through awakening perception, is that our wisdom grows. And our wisdom grows through really deeply in our very beings understanding the truth of impermanence. I mean, opening to sounds, even for a few moments, teaches us how sounds arise, how a certain quality, a certain duration, a certain texture, and then they fade and pass away. When I was on retreat in Massachusetts, at a certain point in the afternoon, there was a logging truck that would climb the hill by the retreat center, There would be a shifting of gears, a rattle of chains, and then it would disappear down the road. And I got to look forward to that sound experience and be moved by it, and knew that it was teaching me. I couldn't have articulated how it was teaching me, but it was teaching me the truth of change. And then there's this insight that we get also into the fact that conditions are arising and passing from moment to moment, that there really isn't anything there. You know, the question asks, what is reborn? What is reborn from moment to moment if conditions are always changing? Well, what is reborn is this awareness of change. So the conditioned nature of reality becomes more and more apparent. You know, a dinner party, all the pieces that come together to make an event, the invitations, the food, the preparation, the music, the conversation. And then the evening grows late, someone puts on their coat, there's a hug, and it's over. So really touching into this conditioned nature of experience. And we know that, you know, with every morning when we look in the mirror and comb our hair, wash our faces, you know, due to conditions, due to the passage of time, we're growing older. Change is happening, change is unfolding. So this insight into anatta, to this inherent emptiness, that there's nothing to hold on to. Yes, we do, we hold on to things, but there really isn't anything to hold on to. And even these teachings, you know, the images given of the monk who comes to the edge of a river with another monk, and there's a woman standing at the river, and the monk carries her across, and the second monk, the young monk, says, "How could you do that? How could you do that? You're a monk, you're not supposed to touch women." And the older monk says, "I've already put her down, but you're still carrying her." So, you know, these teachings, you know, a monk who was dogmatic about his practice and so completely compelled to obey all the precepts according to the discipline of the monks, he would have left that woman standing at the edge of the river. But, you know, circumstances asked him to let go of his dogmatism, or his dogma, or his teachings for that moment. So this insight into impermanence, it grows wisdom. Insight into the conditioned nature of phenomena, it grows wisdom. It's like we touch into that truth. We experience it. And we see the karmic connection between the choices we make and their results. You know, the other day I had some people coming to my house. So I went to the gluten-free bakery and I got some gluten-free chocolate ginger cookies. And the reason I chose chocolate ginger cookies is because I avoid chocolate. It doesn't help me to sleep. So I thought that would be smart. You know, I'll buy cookies that I can't eat, therefore I won't eat them. So my visitors came, they each enjoyed a cookie, there were a few left over. I brought them for lunch yesterday. My trusty managers and retreat organizer each had a cookie, there was one left. I took the tin home and it was sitting on my dining room table last night, and I was tidying up and, oh yeah, that cookie. So, how many years have I been practicing? Removing the lid, mindful. Mindful of seeing, mindful of reaching. Mindful of knowing that I wasn't going to sleep well. It's amazing, yeah. Next time maybe I'll get oatmeal raisin cookies. So these insights grow wisdom. And the third one, of course, is the insight into dukkha. Dukkha, there's different kinds of dukkha which you can learn about. But caring for ourselves every day, we have to do it. In a sense, there is a form of like, okay, here we go again. A bit like Groundhog Day, you know, another morning, another day, getting out of bed, stretching, washing the face, making breakfast. You know, there's that dukkha of caring for ourselves. We bring loving kindness to it as much as we can, but really knowing that it has to be done. And then there's the dukkha of change. You know, things change. You know, beloved teachers grow old, grow ill, and even die. You know, sometimes I think what it would be like when I learned that Joseph has died. It's, oh my God. But it's, you know, it's inevitable. They had an anniversary at the retreat center a few years ago, and I attended it, and it was their 35th, maybe, anniversary. And they said they decided not to wait till their 40th, or maybe it was their 45th, and they had decided not to wait to their 50th because their teachers were growing older. So, you know, this truth of dukkha, of change, and also of this very subtle dis-ease that is present in any experience by virtue of the fact that it changes. Opening to those truths, it grows wisdom. And these spiritual faculties are supporting us in growing that wisdom. So let's just sit for a moment and experience the benefit of these teachings, however they land with us. And remembering that there is this great and beautiful practice that we have encountered in this lifetime. That actually is a source of great joy, great happiness, so we can consider how our practice enriches our friendships, our relationships with elders, our connections with children, our self-understanding, how this practice awakens a deep sense of appreciation for the fleeting nature of all experience. So we bow inwardly, acknowledging our own efforts, may our practice truly be of benefit to all beings.